Thank you so much, and thank you all for being here. I'm really excited to talk about this. This was the first part of my dissertation in my doctoral program, and as Alexa said, I'm really interested in individual and neighborhood level determinants of fear of crime. So just to give you a little bit of an introduction, fear of crime has been defined in the literature in a lot of different ways. This is one example of a definition of fear of crime. There's no standard definition in the literature, and most of the literature looks at fear of crime through a criminology standpoint and not a public health perspective. But I think the reason that I picked this definition to share with you all is because I want to highlight the fact that perception is really important. So in terms of the causes, I'm interested in both individual level factors and area level factors. But before I start talking about that, I just wanted to talk to you a little bit about some of the consequences of fear and acknowledge that there are some positive consequences to being afraid. Positive behavioral changes that people might make if they are in a risky situation. But overall, the vast majority of consequences are extremely negative. There are negative behavioral health implications of being afraid. There are behavioral changes that aren't good for you. There are costs associated with all of these different issues that arise. And that's both for the individual and the neighborhood. The more afraid people are, the more likely they are to participate in physical and psychological retreat from their neighborhood, leading to emptier streets. Emptier streets are generally characterized by more crime and economic decline. So not only are there fewer resources for people in areas that are characterized by a lot of neighborhood level fear, but there are fewer job opportunities as well. So I just want to get back to the perception of risk a little bit. In general, fear is modeled on perception, but people's perception of their risk is not really all that well aligned with actual risk. There's been a lot of research in this area. The people who are generally the most afraid are older women. The people who are generally least afraid are younger men. People who are generally most at risk of victimization in neighborhoods are younger men. People who are least afraid or least at risk of victimization are older women. So perception of risk and actual risk is not always all that well aligned, which means that often the people who are the most afraid don't have a lot of risk to back up their fear, which becomes a problem if you're internalizing all that fear without any positive behavior changes leading to minimization of risk. So in 1980, Lewis wrote an article that called for policy changes that could reduce the incidence of fear and not just crime, because anything directed only at crime will have an incomplete benefit when it comes to fear reduction. So that was 1980. That was a long time ago. We're still talking about this, so clearly things still need to be done. So what causes fear? I'm going to go over a little bit about a conceptual model that I developed as part of my dissertation, looking at really what is leading to all of this fear, specifically among adolescents. So I categorized the components into three different areas. I looked at individual vulnerabilities. If you look at physical vulnerability, I think that's probably why older women are more afraid. As you get older, as you age, you're less likely to recover well from an injury, you're more likely to have a severe medical response to an attack, and so I think that, that physical vulnerability probably leads to fear. I also think there are perceptions that lead to increased levels of fear, and those are at the bottom. And then on the left-hand side are all of the neighborhood level determinants that I thought could lead to increased fear among adolescents. I'll get back to this conceptual model in a few slides. So I used the Project on Human Development in Chicago Neighborhoods. It's a longitudinal cohort study. It's large, over 6,000 randomly selected children, adolescents, and their primary caretakers were interviewed. So I liked that I had both information on the individual and information on their caretaker. And then it was linked with the systematic social observation data, which used researcher-collected information on neighborhoods. And that was really key for me in doing this research. Most of the research in this area looks at individuals' perceptions of their neighborhood. And since we're talking so much about how perceptions can be off, The way I might describe my neighborhood might be different from the way you might describe my neighborhood, right? So I liked that this data had objectively measured information on neighborhoods where they really had researchers walk up and down block faces, checking off boxes, measuring things about the physical structure, social structure, decay, things like that in the neighborhood. They videotaped these, they had logs independently verified, and then you could link each of these the individual level surveys with the neighborhood level factors. So I used four cohorts from waves 2 and 3. Unfortunately, they did not repeat the fear question among the same cohorts between waves, so I couldn't analyze these data longitudinally. So instead, I pooled four different cohorts from two different waves to do pooled cross-sectional data analysis. So my final sample size for individuals was 2,574, and those were in 80 neighborhood clusters. So my main dependent variable is this question, how afraid are you that you might be hurt by violence in your neighborhood? They asked this question, and there were three outcomes, a little afraid, very afraid, or not afraid. This is the distribution at baseline, pretty good distribution across all three. Again, I just want to reference, this is my conceptual model. In an ideal world, I would love to have information in all of these different areas. And then this was my measurement model. I had pretty good proxies for some things, not great proxies for other things, and some areas where I just didn't have a good proxy at all. But that's helpful because now I know what omitted variables are in my model or not in my model. So this was my regressor of interest. I was really interested in, I have an individual level regressor of interest and then a couple neighborhood level regressors of interest. So at the individual level, I was interested in exposure to violence. I was able to categorize violence exposure in two different types of violence exposure. So based on the questions they asked, I created this hierarchical variable that slotted people into either no exposure to violence, which you can see is only 6% of the population of these 10 to 17-year-olds. They knew of violence happening to another person, saw violence happening to another person, or actually experienced violent victimization personally. So vast majority of adolescents in this population either witnessed or experienced violence themselves. And I was really interested in how different types of violence exposure led to fear. These are some of my regressors of interest, just control covariates. I also had parental slash family level variables that I included, household income, caretaker marital status, depression, and employment status. And then these were some of the neighborhood level regressors of interest. So I was primarily interested in physical disorder, physical decay, and social disorder. So these were all scales that were created and validated by the study PIs, and police visibility was a control variable that I wanted to include. I wasn't quite sure which direction of effect police visibility would have. Maybe if you see police on your block face, you think maybe there's trouble and that makes you more afraid, or you could see police on your block face and think there's help available if something goes wrong. But I was primarily interested in the three scales in the middle. I just want to note that in addition to household level income, I also had neighborhood cluster SES that I controlled for. So these are the 10 items in the physical disorder scale. Ranges from 0 to 10 with a higher score, meaning more physical disorder. There are things that lots of people in this field refer to as incivilities, trash on the ground, graffiti, things like that. Physical decay refers to the actual physical structures within the neighborhood and what those look like. So the condition of housing units, condition of commercial buildings, things like that. And again, higher scores mean more decay. And then these are the elements in the social disorder scale. So it's more of the social behaviors that researchers were looking for. People drinking in public on the block face, perception of gang members hanging out, things like that. So for my analysis, I did a generalized ordered Loget model. I had this three-level category of fear. And to be honest, I wish I had more categories within there because I'm not sure none, a little, and a lot really captures nuances of how afraid you are in a neighborhood, but rather than collapsing it into two categories, I analyzed it as a three-category variable. I couldn't do an ordered logit because I failed the assumption of proportional hazards, and so I did a generalized ordered logit, which allows for partial proportional hazards. It allows for the slopes of each regression for each individual outcome to change. I singly imputed data. I know that multiple imputation is the standard, but you can't combine generalized ordered logits with multiple imputation in data. So I used a singly imputed data set, recognizing that my standard errors are probably a little bit larger than they should be because it only accounts for the within imputation variation and not the between imputation variation. I only imputed independent variables, and I did sensitivity analyses between singly imputed and multiply imputed data sets in other analyses, and in general the qualitative conclusions were the same, but the variances were a little bit smaller among the singly imputed data sets. So I'm presenting marginal effects, which is the absolute difference in probability. So it's a percentage point change in the difference of being in an outcome with a one-unit change in the predictor. So a one-unit change in a linear predictor or going from 0 to 1 in a dichotomous predictor. So in terms of my hypothesis about exposure to violence, I hypothesized that greater exposure to violence would lead to more fear. And there was a 9 percentage point reduction in the probability of being unafraid in one's neighborhood when you go from no experience with violence to seeing violence. And similarly, an 8 percentage point difference for those who experienced violence personally. Other significant results, some of them are very intuitive. The older you are, the more likely you are to be unafraid. Females were less likely to feel unafraid. Those in the two highest income brackets were more likely to feel unafraid and less likely to feel very afraid. So normally I would say that this is probably just a proxy for the type of neighborhood you live in, but I'm controlling out the neighborhood level socioeconomic status. So even removing the effect of the neighborhood level SES, there's still an income effect for kids who are in the wealthier categories feeling safer. I just want to talk about employment for a minute. This is adolescent employment status, not parental employment status. So those who were employed were less likely to feel afraid. This is one of those variables that highlights the fact that there's a lot of endogeneity in this model. I'm not sure if those who are already a little bit unafraid are more likely to go out in the neighborhood to seek employment status, or if maybe being in the neighborhood because you are employed gives you more feelings of social cohesion and interaction and then causes you to feel less afraid. So this was a question that basically asked, how far do you expect to go in school? Those who expected to attend any college had an 8 percentage point increase in feeling unafraid, in their probability of feeling unafraid. If they expected to graduate from college or go beyond college, they had a 7 percentage point increase in their probability of feeling unafraid and a 6 percentage point decrease in their probability of feeling very afraid. So in terms of caretaker, this is another interesting result. I thought most of the literature for a whole host of outcomes shows that a two-partner household has a lot of protective effects. And I found that those who had caretakers who were married or living with partners were less likely to feel unafraid in their neighborhood. And I thought about this for a long time, and my only hypothesis about this is that these kids are exposed to so much violence, both witnessing and experiencing, that my assumption is that a lot of this happens within the home. And so having those two partners, if they're violent with each other, really negates any of the positive benefits that you would normally see in a two-partner household. So in terms of the neighborhood effects, social disorder, increases in social disorder in the social disorder scale were associated with reductions in feeling unafraid. So going from the minimum observed value in the social disorder scale, which was 0, to the maximum observed value in the social disorder scale, the likelihood of feeling unafraid was reduced by about 14 percentage points. So that's a pretty big reduction. Physical decay and physical disorder were not significant in this model. I have some hypotheses about why. I'm not sure if they're correct, but this is a pretty big model, and the generalized ordered logit uses a lot of power, and we only had 80 neighborhood clusters. So the variation within the neighborhood level variables is pretty small. So I think it's harder to achieve significant results in these neighborhood level factors. I wish that there was, what they did was they walked up and down the block faces and then they collapsed those block faces into a single neighborhood cluster. So I think if there was more variation in those, perhaps we would have seen more significant results. Anyway, one other neighborhood level factor was significant, and that was police visibility. The more block faces where police were visible, the higher the probability of feeling unafraid and the lower the probability of feeling very afraid. So this was a bit of a concerning finding for me and the rest of my dissertation committee. We were concerned that maybe across race ethnicities this wasn't a consistent finding, so we did include interaction effects between race ethnicity and the police visibility variable and didn't find any significant results there. But I did want to acknowledge that we looked at it. So as with everything, there are plenty of limitations. Reverse causality, which I talked about a little bit, omitted variables, imperfect measures of things for sure. These are regionally specific. It's from Chicago. I did this work when I was living in Los Angeles. Now I live in Reno, Nevada. All of these places are really different from Chicago. It just happens to be that that's where the data were available with objectively measured neighborhood level characteristics. And you can imagine that that's a pretty pricey study to undertake. So there's not a lot of it out there. So just acknowledging this is Chicago at a certain point of time, not sure if it applies to the rest of the world. So the implications, so I had some implications for research. I'm really curious about the educational expectation variable. What is that a proxy for? Is that a proxy for self-efficacy? What is the mechanism that leads kids who have higher educational expectations of themselves to feel less afraid in life of violent victimization? Additional research using better specified variables for violence, I think, is important. More objectively measured neighborhood research, which I've already acknowledged is tough because it's so pricey. And then causal studies. This was a cross-sectional cohort study. I couldn't do longitudinal data analysis on this data set. If there was if there were data that were longitudinal, I would love to do causal research. So the implications for policy, as crime has gone down over the past 20 years, fear has increased dramatically. That is, I think, a clear indicator that this is an area where policy really should work towards managing some of this fear. Fear has a lot of deleterious consequences that I talked about in the beginning, from physical consequences, from manifestations of biological stress, to behavioral health consequences. Something has to be done about fear, especially this cohort was adolescents. The behavioral health consequences are pretty clear for fear, and from a life course perspective, if we can manage that earlier on in the life course, there'd be much better mental health outcomes in the long term. So again, policies aimed at crime reduction will have an incomplete benefit since people's perceptions are not always well aligned with their actual risk. Policies could target those who are most at risk of becoming fearful based on the violent victimization information. I think that would be a good place to start. And then because the police visibility variable was pretty clear that this type, and so I should acknowledge the police visibility was police present on the block face walking. So to me that sounds like a type of community policing, not traditional policing, so there could be implications for community policing models to help adolescents feel safer. Sorry, it's going backwards. I just want to acknowledge my dissertation committee who helped me with this, an outside reviewer, and then the National Archive of Criminal Justice and all of the study PIs for supplying me with the data. So I added this, but I know that we're saving them till the end, so thank you so much.